You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at
And welcome to the Archaeology Podcast, Episode 12. I'm Chris Webster.
And I'm April Camp Whitaker. On today's show, we're going to riff off of each other and talk about the material culture of archaeologists.
Let's dig a little deeper.
Archaeologists, one of the things we think about all the time is material culture, because that's what we study. The actual objects that people in the past are using, how they use them. And so one day, while thinking about other people's material culture, I started to think about our own and kind of pondering how, as archaeologists, we sort of build up things like our toolkits. And, you know, when you go to conferences, everybody has very distinctive styles of dress and, you know, almost regional material cultural attributes that signify where they work or who they work with. And so I just been really curious about this. And this is something that I've been playing around with and thinking about. And so Chris and I thought it'd be fun just to do kind of a random episode where we talk about stuff like this, especially, you know, as our major conference comes up, which is always a great time to observe an archaeologist in the wild. So I was just thinking about this and thinking about even crazy things like, what was your first tool? Like, how did you build your very first toolkit? And what did it end up with? How did it get there? Like, I got a trowel because I think that's everyone's mandatory first tool. And it was like a hand-me-down from someone else from previous excavations. But it was great because it was pre-worn into like the perfect shape. So it wasn't new where you have to like sharpen it and form it and get it to be to fit in your hand right and to not have a super pointy tip. It was just absolutely perfect. And of course, like two seasons later, I lost it. and someone else now has this perfect trowel and I have had to move on.
Nice. Yeah, my first tool was probably a trowel as well. It's hard to say because my first project, for my field school, it was in Africa and I didn't bring anything. Like, I didn't know what I was supposed to bring out there. So I brought nothing and, all the tools were like supplied. But when I got back from that, I went on my first CRM project and, I showed up also with nothing and they're like, this is an excavation, go buy some tools. And they gave me like a list of things to buy. So I think my first tool was actually a handful of tools, which included, you know, the pointed trowel and then, a square trowel, which I bought like the most ridiculous square trowel ever. It was like this enormous thing that you actually use on concrete. And then a plumb bob and a tape measure. I think that was the first like four things that I picked up, all at once, you know, just from the local hardware store in Grand Forks, North Dakota. And, they're like, you better get a Marshalltown. Don't walk out of there without a Marshalltown. Of course, the Home Depot or Lowe's or whatever the hell it was in Grand Forks did not sell Marshalltown trowels. So I got whatever the heck I got. And eventually I think replaced it later. But yeah, that was my first set of tools. And I think I used that trowel for a really long time actually. And then I really just upgraded. There was nothing wrong with it, but I just kind of upgraded to a different one and then just kind of left it. But we can talk about the sacredness of tools if you want, because I have some serious thoughts on that as well.
No, that'd be interesting. I have to admit that my first contract gig, they actually supplied us with tape measures.
Mm, nice.
And I still have my tape measure from this, you know, contract job in 2005 as part of my dig kit. That somehow it's horribly bright yellow, so it's never walked off.
Nice.
But yeah, no, that's interesting. And we should probably talk about Marshalltowns at some point too.
Yes. You know,
the social stigmas of not working with the proper tool, especially in certain regions. Maybe it varies a little bit depending on where you work.
Well, and that's what I want to, you know, getting into sort of, I mean, really talking about the material culture of these things and the ritual behind all of it. I never really bought that. Like, I collect certain things. There's definitely some stuff that I kind of obsess about and I collect. But I'll tell you what, trowels are not one of them. Some people, they like, their whole identity is built around their trowel. There's a guy I know from the Southwest. I don't know if he's still doing this or not, but he would like, you could pay him and he would do this like jeweled up carved handle trowel thing. He'd take your trowel, take the handle off of it and like craft something for you. And it was just like this amazing thing. And they're beautiful. They're great. They work well, you know, all that. And, but I just, a trowel was always just a tool for me. I don't know. I don't know what it was. Maybe it's because I came to archaeology a little later in life. I was like in my, you know, I think I was 30, 31 when I first did my first, project. And, you know, it wasn't really a defining thing for me. It was just like, okay, here's the tool I'm using right now. You know, it's like my first tool was actually a shovel, quite frankly. Not my own shovel, but like a, maybe that's why trowels are special to us, because they're often not given to us by our companies. We bring that with us. Whereas a shovel, you know, you kind of, you're usually handed a shovel from the company. You don't often travel around with your, that's not to say you don't. I mean, I did meet a girl on that very first project that walked around with her own, she had her own, like, it looked like this silver plated shovel thing. It was crazy. I can't even explain it. But yeah, I just never really put a lot of stock in it. You know, like the trowel, the compass, things like that. These people, they lose it and it's like they lost their, you know, firstborn child. And it's like a catastrophic thing. I've lost like three or four compasses. I don't care. I'll just go buy another one. You know, in trowels, and really lost a trowel or broken one for that matter. But if I did, I would simply just go buy another one. So, you know, never been that big a deal to me.
I think it's that with certain tools, you get them, you spend time using them and spend so much time with them that eventually mm-hmm. you form them to yeah. meet your needs. So, you know, in different regions, people spend hours sharpening their trowels.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you do this, Chris.
I have.
Right. So yeah. especially clay soils, things like that. You spend hours sharpening your trowels. You form them. You find the one that's comfortable. You know, the wood and the handle soft. Or I have no idea. They've always sort of been tools for me too. But you definitely kind of make them into something that works for you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of it. You get this visceral connection because you do. You bring your trowel with you everywhere you go. But at the same time, like when I worked for different companies, there was like a shovel that for me was perfect for skim shoveling. It was like the right length, the right sharpness. The blade somehow was like flatter than other blades. I don't know what it was, but you know, I would like get there a couple minutes early so I could get my shovel, even though it wasn't my shovel. I had to return it at the end of every project, but it just worked. It worked better for me than the other shovels. It was more comfortable to use.
Well, I definitely get that.
Yeah, because you spend hours using those tools. So it's important to have that kind of comfort level with them.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be part of it. But
I feel like with trowels too, and with shovels as well, especially if you have your own and you keep sharpening it, and you know, it'll dull itself naturally as well. And the whole sharpening thing, it really depends on where you're at. You know, if you're working in a place that has a lot of roots and things, it helps to have a nice edge on your trowel or shovel so you can just cut right through that stuff and you don't have to grab a different tool. I mean, if you're in like a high sandy environment, then it's going to be hard to keep an edge on it because the sand just dulls the crap out of it super fast. That being said, you know, you were mentioning people spending all this time sharpening. I mean, I sharpen my trowel because I need to sharpen my trowel in certain circumstances. If I'm like out here in the Great Basin, when it's all, you know, the few excavations I've done out here where it's all just like hard, compact dirt and rocks, there's really no point in sharpening the trowel at all because you're not cutting through anything. There's nothing. You really just need a pickaxe, quite frankly, and not a trowel. But when people do sharpen them, and like you said, they get comfortable with what they have. I mean, I've seen these people with these trowels, these pointed trowels that are like down to a nub, you know, it's like 2 inches long at this point. And they're like, oh, but that's because I've been using it for 20 years. And it was like, yeah, well, now it takes you 17 times longer to dig your unit because your trowel is a quarter the size. you know, I mean, how is that still efficient? I don't get it. You know, I mean, maybe buy another trowel for that big, you know, those big movements, those big arm motions, and then maybe, you know, dig around the small finds with your little old trowel. But yeah, like I said, it's a tool. When it stops becoming effective, I replace it.
You know, I have a confession, which is I hate buying things new and expensive. And so I actually pick up most of my gear at estate sales.
Nice.
Because, you know, periodically you run into someone who for some reason has like three trowels and, you know, they're 50 cents to a dollar, or, you know, metric fold wooden folding rulers. I'm like, oh, sweet. And then I think it's also, I work a lot of field schools, and so your stuff has a tendency to sort of walk or get integrated into the larger field school kits.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so having stuff that you just don't really, you didn't spend a lot of money on, you don't care about it. If that tape measure walks away, it walks away. You got it for 50 cents.
Mm-hmm.
I think is sort of, it's sort of become my mentality on spending for my kids.
Yeah. And that's probably good too, because some of that stuff, even if you buy a good one, we're just so hard on the gear that, you know, it might not last all that long unless you really actively try to keep it clean. But then an expensive tape measure, you know, might only cost you $20, you know, for like a really high end tape measure, because you don't need something massive, just 3 or 5 meters. Typically five is kind of the maximum I think you would need in most cases. But I usually try to shoot for the 3 meter one, because most of the stuff I'm doing is way less than that, as far as the tape measure goes, and that's just fine. But and that makes it smaller and lighter, and I can carry it with me and things like that. But you know, speaking of those other tools, you know, what other kind of stuff do we have in our toolkit? That first project I was on, like I said, I bought a handful of things, but then my next project was in downtown Miami. And when you started, it was an ongoing project. There was already people working there, and we kind of had people cycling in and out because it was a longer project. But when you got there, they handed you a bucket full of tools. It had a clipboard in it. It had a plumb bob, and it had a tape measure, and it had all the things you would need for excavation. I think that's, I don't know how common that is, because that's the only project I was ever handed like a whole bucket of tools in CRM. And I think it's partly because they were technically a nonprofit organization, and they had to spend money. Like, they had to spend, you know, their money by the end of the year. That's also why I started in like the second week of December. And I think at the end of my first week, they were having a Christmas party. And of course, it's Florida, so it was outside with shorts and it was a barbecue. but we had this Christmas party, and everybody working got an envelope that with a custom designed, it was like a line drawing of a site that they had worked on a while back that was famous now. And there was a $100 bill in the envelope too, because, you know, they got to unload a large amount of their cash by the end of the year. That was part of their mandate. So I think that's why we got tools. I'm not really sure, but, you know, I never really asked, but, that definitely helped kind of start my toolkit. You know, and we have different toolkits for different things, but, you know, what's in your basic toolkit, April, besides, you know, the standard things?
You know, so I have kind of the standards, and then a lot of the projects I've worked on, either when I've worked for contract companies, you're expected to bring kind of your clipboard, your trowel, your tape measures, basics. But they've always provided kind of the stranger equipment, even things like plumb bobs. Like, if you have one, great. If you don't, you know, there's some kits that we take out of the field that are the dig kits and things like that.
Yeah.
And then of course with field schools, at least all the ones that I have been on or participated in provided basically everything for students with the concept that, oh, you're a student. You don't know if you're going to grow up and be an archaeologist. The whole point of this is to experiment and decide if you like it. So we were not going to make you buy materials. Here's everything you need. Just leave it at the end of the field school.
What? You don't get to keep it?
I have some stories on that one.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think some of the weirder stuff is I have some mapping equipment, you know, that I've thrown into my kit over time. You know, I want a specialized ruler that will let me map more easily. And I want a compass and a protractor and things like that, because I enjoy having that. And it makes my life a little bit easier.
Yeah.
But, you know, for most part, I think it's pretty basic. And it's mainly because I do so much that's field school related and mm-hmm. through academia, where, you know, schools and projects acquire their own repository of tools.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, it's I was just thinking as you said that, I mean, I've only done like the one field school because I'm not on the academic side of it. And, you know, a lot of times we build our dig kits based on what the company didn't ask for back when your project is over. Like, I've got a whole collection of chaining pins. Anybody that doesn't know what those are, they're like the red and white striped, kind of a thin pointed piece of metal that's kind of wrapped into a circle at the top. And we often use them for running a string or a line in between two of them and using that as, you know, either a boundary or some kind of measuring against line, you know, something like that. But we use chaining pins a lot for different things. And often it's not even purposeful. It's just like it's in my kit because I grabbed it, and I usually have two set up to be on it with a string that's 2 meters long, so I can do like profile drawings and stuff. And I just you know, the project is over and you leave and you get to the next project and you open up your kit and it's like, oh crap, I still have chaining pins. So there's things like that. And then there's also you know, like clipboards and pens and pencils and flagging tape. I did these two massive projects with my own company in 2015, about 45,000 acres worth of survey. And that was a total of about, I think, 9 months worth of fieldwork, give or take, about 8 or 9 months worth of fieldwork between the two projects. And easily for the first like 5 months, we used flagging tape that I had simply collected over the last 10 years of doing archaeology for other companies. like I just had buckets of this stuff. And we were, you know, flagging tape's the kind of thing you can't really reuse. You really have to try hard to reuse it. So even if on one site, you'll typically just pull it off of bin flags and kind of put it in your pocket and throw it away at the end of the day. So it kind of goes fast. But that's how much I had before I actually had to start buying more flagging tape. It was ridiculous how much I had.
I have a similar pin flag collection.
Oh, yeah.
Where, you know, you throw your backpack in the car at the end of the day and like 4 pin flags fall onto the floor. And at the end of it, you're cleaning your car and you're like, oh, God, I have like 30 pin flags.
Yeah.
Okay, then.
Yep.
Yeah, definitely pin flags and flagging tape are easily acquired in Sharpies and pencils. Mm-hmm. And they walk quite easily.
The two items that they never want you to walk away with are GPSs, and by that I usually mean not just like the smaller garments and things like that, although a lot of companies do use those, and those are kind of easy to walk away with because they are small and you just throw it in your pack. I guess three items. So GPSs, radios, handheld. I've seen radios walk off so many times because they are easy to just forget about, and then you know, like a Trimble GPS. You know, those are. That's hard to walk off with as well, because usually you have to turn that in to download the data. However, Munsell books. On the East Coast, when I was doing shovel testing, usually most of us had a Munsell book that was given to us by the company. Some companies just bought like the 7.5, the 10YR, and maybe the 2.5 page, and so it's just you can buy those separately, so they just give us those. But I happen to have a full Munsell book in my bag when I let's just say left in a hurry from a company in the Southeast, and I didn't even know it was there. It'd been in there for about 2 weeks. I hadn't been in the field. I'd been in the office and then left, and my wife and I picked up and we went from South Carolina to a project in Ohio, and I still had that Munsell in my bag, and I still didn't know until I was like 3 weeks into this Ohio project and I'm looking for something else and it's like this Munsell buried in there. I'm like, huh, score, that's like a $600 book. So
yeah, I was gonna say,
yeah, they're not cheap.
I think all the problems, I mean, especially with field schools, Munsell books we keep a pretty tight eye on. And they live in kind of a master kit
yeah. You can
borrow things from. But, you know, we actually keep a tight eye on chaining pins because those aren't super cheap either.
No.
And they're really easy to walk away with because you mm-hmm. do. You know, you stick them in your bag and they're gone.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah.
All right. Well, we've got a lot more to talk about on this and some other directions to go in future segments. So we'll do that in a second after we get back from this break. Archaeotech Podcast, hosted by Chris Webby Webster and Chris Boone Sims, is a show dedicated to the technology of the modern archaeologist. On the Archaeotech podcast, we interview people using interesting tech, and we dig into the issues, advantages, and try to uncover the disadvantages of the digital age and going paperless. We all know there is no paper in the future, or should we say, paper has no future. Check out the show at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeotech. Let's get back to the show. Okay, we're back, and this is something, there's something else in the dig kit that everybody tends to get, tends to pick up, except we don't typically steal these things. we find them from other places, but, and I'm curious to see the difference between CRM and academic in this respect, honestly. But the two things that I can think of, especially for excavations, are dental picks and chopsticks. And I mean, I always had, you know, you could usually go to a dentist. I actually went to my dentist a long time ago when I first got into archaeology, and I still actually had a dentist. And I said, hey, do you have like old dental picks? And he's like, yeah, we usually send them off, but I've got a bundle of them here. And he gave me like 40 of them. So I never actually had to get dental picks again. And people have to be careful. A lot of companies won't actually let you use dental picks, because if you use them incorrectly on the wrong type of material, you can actually scratch it. You know, you try to use them on ceramics and stuff and the wrong kinds of soil, and they can actually do more harm than good. So, but chopsticks, on the other hand, you can do all kinds of fancy things with chopsticks. I usually had, in fact, in my dig kit now, I just moved and I saw this stuff. I've got, I think, probably 4 or 5 chopsticks whittled down into slightly different shapes, like a little spoon type of shape and little spatula kind of shapes and different things for doing stuff. And then I've got a couple just like untouched chopsticks that I can, you know, whittle down and do whatever I need to with. But, whenever you go to one of those Chinese places, and everybody knows what I'm talking about, you get those chopsticks that are kind of like balsa wood. Those kind of suck for eating on, but they're not too bad for really soft, like I'd use them for digging around soft sand in pottery in the southeast, where the pottery's wet underground, and it's just this really soft stuff. So creating a little like spatula kind of thing out of a chopstick and then excavating around that nice and slowly really worked out well. But then you get those really fancy chopsticks, the harder ones, the harder like bamboo ones, where they're really smooth. You know, you break them apart, you don't need to like rub them on each other because they're already fancy. Those are great too for other applications in like harder soils and working with harder materials. So April, do you use chopsticks much in what you do, or you got other fancier academic tools? Because you guys have all the money, you know that, right?
Yeah, academia. We're just rolling in it. You know, there's some chopsticks. I think in some ways, at least I've done more stuff in kind of the Southwest with our lovely loose soil. Mm-hmm. I think maybe there's a little bit, the projects I've been on, everybody kind of has something like that. Dental picks too. Mm-hmm. We were lucky, one of the projects I was lucky had a volunteer who was a dentist.
Nice.
And gave us all dental picks. Just super convenient. So there's always some of that. And then there's a little bit of dental or like chopstick use, but I don't think I've seen people kind of whittling them and forming them. But, you know, that's probably just the people I've run into. Mm-hmm. But we always have things like spoons.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get a spoon and then you bend it to be a right angle so that you can scoop out deep holes. And so there's a certain amount of time spent before the field season in goodwill.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of trolling, being like, all right, we lost one of our ladles last season, so we need another couple of spoons.
Nice.
Or sieves, things like little sieves when you just want to quickly kind of see if there's anything in a small area. Or, kind of reuse of household items I've seen a lot more of.
How often is it the little like, you know, camera lens cleaner type blow tool that blows air and little brushes that you see always on like movies and stuff? You got the little, usually a paleontologist, honestly, not even an archaeologist, but usually a paleontologist like choo, 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 just doing this little thing. That doesn't happen very much in our field, does it, in reality?
Oh, all the time. You don't spend hours like airbrushing off everything.
Right?
Yeah, especially in contract where you guys have unlimited time. Just like we in academia have unlimited funds.
Yes. Usually the only shade we have on those projects is the bucket of the bulldozer sitting over the tops of our heads. That's the shade that we get provided.
Yep, so, that sounds...
Yeah. You know, one of the other things that's part of our material culture, I think, is the container that holds all these things. I have, you know... as far as I can tell, you go on a CRM project and a lot of dig kits, they might look slightly different on the surface because people have, you know, there's the different manufacturers, different styles of things. But if you were to look at the types of tools people have, they're all probably fairly uniform. Like somebody might have some crazy thing, but everybody's kind of got the list. You know what I mean? It just looks a little different. But things to hold those in, my God, have I seen variations on that. Anything from, you know, the bucket they sell at Home Depot with like the canvas thing that goes around it to hold all your tools. I've seen those. I usually just use like, I had a backpack and I had different containers within that backpack and I just put everything in there rather than have a separate kit for it. But I've seen tool bags. One girl that I worked with had, you know what an ammo can is? Like those green ammo cans.
Oh yeah.
That was her dig kit. I don't know. It's what a, I mean, when you guys give your field school students all your tools, do you give them in something or you just let them figure it out?
So for field schools, I've been on every, it's like every excavation unit, which generally has two people or more, mm-hmm. gets like a box, like a plastic box of some kind. And that's varied from, I've seen like the file, like plastic filing boxes where it's got a little handle and it's kind of tall and rectangular, but has a nice latch to it, to like fishing tackle kind of boxes. Anything that closes is relatively lightweight. And often it's nice if it has kind of two levels of organization, one for your small tools mm-hmm. and one for your larger like trowels. And we just sort of prep them and load it and say, okay, every unit needs a plumb bob and a line level, and it needs two flat nose and two triangular trowels, and it needs a whisk broom and a dustpan. And so we pre-stock them.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they're given their dig kits and they're responsible for those for the season.
Yeah.
And then we inventory them at the end to make sure we actually get most of the items back. and then it's nice too, because they can stick bags and whatever they need in there. But then people also have their personal ones, you know, if they're in the field longer. And I did work with someone who also used an ammo can.
Yeah.
One of the big ammo boxes, except the project we were on was on top of a mountain.
Hmm.
So she got to hike it up every day, which seemed unnecessary to me.
Yeah.
So I've seen some variation, and I have personal variation depending on what the project I'm doing is. So if I'm doing contract or survey project, it's so much more convenient just to have everything in your backpack
mm-hmm.
and to pack your pack, because you're carrying it, you're walking with it. You can bring it in. But when I'm doing car projects where you get out of the car and you walk to the unit, I like to use something like, you know, like a little plastic box or a kind of tackle box, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen vintage makeup kits.
Nice. That's cool.
Those are classy. Yep.
Yeah. Well, I think I definitely want to spend the third segment kind of talking about why we keep all this stuff, like why our kits are the way they are, things like that. But so just keep that in mind if you're listening to this. That's I really want to tackle that in the third segment, unless we get to it at the end of this one. But we're going to keep talking about different things, different material cultures. You know, I think we've got some other stuff in our notes here, but one of the things I don't see that I was just thinking about is for traveling archaeologists. You know, we definitely have a different material culture from that standpoint. And even academic archaeologists that go on different digs and go and do different things in different places, maybe not for the whole entire year. But when you're getting ready for the field season, April, I'm sure you go to, you know, your section of the garage or closet or wherever, and you just start inventorying your gear and what you have and seeing what you can replace and what, you know, how many more estate sales you're going to have to go to and clothing. And you have stuff that you only use for the field, probably, you know, stuff that's just like packed away until you go into the field. Contract archaeologists aren't any different. It's just that, you know, we're wearing those clothing and have those items more often than we don't, because we're always working. So, I don't know. It's, just trying to think about some different items. I think you can lump into this whole material culture aspect, your vehicle, your type of car you have. Some people have whatever they have, you know, whatever they had getting into this, that's what they have now. But you hit these career field techs and crew chiefs and these people that are just career shovel bums, really, regardless of their position, they're career traveling archaeologists. this one guy I met not too long ago, I mean, he had, what was it, like a, I think it was an older, like, 4Runner type truck, like SUV, but he had created this whole wooden thing in the back that his screen fit perfectly onto the top of it. It had all these drawers with all these supplies and things in it. I mean, he could get out at a moment's notice and do anything archaeologically, from survey to excavation to whatever, and it all fit perfectly and magically into the back of his vehicle. And that was just designed for that. But other people, you know, might be just driving around in whatever they have and make that work. So I don't know.
Yeah, there's definitely some of that. I've worked with someone who had the back of their pickup truck fitted out to live in, essentially. Mm-hmm. So that when, you know, out in the Southwest, in some areas, you do a lot more camping-based projects.
Yeah.
So, you know, he had drawers and cupboards, and it was a house. It was a small, convenient house. But, you know, it worked, and it made life a lot easier, because sometimes it's nice not to, you know, be digging through the piles mm-hmm. of junk in the back of your car trying to find what you think might be your last pair of clean underwear.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know if your company flies people a lot, but if you fly a lot doing contract jobs,
mm-hmm.
thinking about, all right, what do I pack? How do I pack it? How do I get all of my gear safely from place to place and bring the clothing that I'm going to need, but not have like 3 rollerboard suitcases? You know, yeah. And look like a proper archaeologist with one battered backpack,
right?
And then a smaller day pack.
Well, I definitely think you learn along the way what you need and what you don't need, what you can live without, what you can, you know, you learn to appreciate the things that have more than one use. Like cooking equipment, for example. You know, you see people who are new in the field, and you tell them, oh, you know, it's nice to just cook in the hotel room or at your campsite or whatever, and they'll bring 65 different things that each do one thing separately. When once you realize, like, especially if you're in a hotel room, hey, buy like a rice cooker, and it's also a crock pot, and it will also do these things. And, you know, buy like an electric skillet, because it'll do literally a million different things. And you can, you know, you can get a lot of functionality out of stuff like that. So that's definitely part of our material culture. And you can tell how that changes and evolves, how long somebody's been in the field and how much they've paid attention to what other people do. Quick story, my wife and I, you know, I had been shovel bumming for a bit before her and I kind of got together, and then we started working together and going on projects together. And then when we just sold both of our vehicles and we bought a Toyota 4Runner and decided to shovel bum across the United States to make it out west, we brought so much stuff because we weren't really used to that kind of travel. We were used to traveling where, you know, every 5 or 10 days we were back home. So you could restock, you could, you know, if you made poor choices out in the field, you could change those when you got home and leave something there you found that you didn't use, or pick something up that you wish you'd had. But when you're going on the road and you live on the road, it's a completely different set of things that you bring. And my God, I'm so happy for tablets now too, because this is where I really became appreciative of reading on a tablet. Because it was later on in our shovel bumming that those became a thing. But early on, like, we had this Toyota 4Runner, and we had all our camping gear, we had all our excavation gear, our survey gear. And then we had, you know, stuff for cooking in the hotel room, stuff for cooking at a campsite. It was just full to the gills of all kinds of stuff, including, like, I think we started out with like one Rubbermaid tub full of books that we brought with us at the start of the journey. And by the end of it, we were jamming more books into like every nook and cranny we could get, because you're just always buying books. And my God, it was just so much stuff. And if I had to do it all over again, I mean, don't get me wrong, I tend to like to be comfortable, so I'll probably bring more than the average person, but I think those choices are smarter now that I've been in, you know, doing this longer. But I don't know, just some observations from living on the road, I guess.
I think of it too, and kind of wonder about investiture in the material, like what you're bringing and what you have. Because I don't know, I can't tell if there's a true difference between academia and contract. You know, in academia, we're out in the field maybe a couple months out of a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so that we definitely invest in equipment and personal gear and supplies and clothes. But at the same time, you know, when I've worked with people who do contract work professionally, it's your job. There's a payoff to truly investing in high quality, long lasting, proper gear, where if you're out every day, you want to be dry. So it's worth paying a little bit more to get a nice rain gear.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, I work in southeastern Colorado right now and we don't really get rain. And so like, I have some really old, cheap rain gear for the one day it might rain on me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm not out there. I'm not going to have to stay out all day. If it rains, figure something out, or worse comes to worse, you're wet one day.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of wonder about that too. I don't know if you have any observations, Chris, because you've done a lot more contract work.
Yeah, it really depends on where you're working, because sometimes, sometimes you really don't need like solid rain gear, because the minute it starts raining, you head in, because rain means lightning and lightning means get the hell out of the field. So, you know, it's like down in, you know, where you work in Colorado, if it did rain there, you guys are going inside like pretty much immediately. So you might need some light, like cheap rain gear that you can just throw on so you don't get totally soaked, but then you're going to take that off in a few minutes and let it dry out. Whereas if you're working up in like Washington State, I had to buy like some really solid rain gear because we were on an excavation in, I think it was November, December, January timeframe. And it was snowing and raining pretty much all day, every day. and we were just working in it. You know, we went out and my wife and I just did a small thing, kind of a side project with that same company up there out on the Washington coast. And we were shovel testing. And I mean, it was literally rain/snow for the whole time we were out there. And we had, and we were working in like these like blackberry bushes and things like that. So we not only had good rain gear, but thick rain gear so it wouldn't get torn up. So you have to really think about, you have to think about the circumstance you're in and what you're going to need based on that circumstance. Now, if you live on the road, that becomes an incredibly complicated question, because are you just going to pack all these different things, or do you pack like one thing that works for most of your circumstances, but maybe not all of them? And then you just kind of hedge your bets and hope for the best, you know, unless you've got a massive vehicle and you can carry everything with you. But most people have like a small car or a Subaru or something. And while those do hold a lot of things, you're still limited, you know, you still don't have like a ton of space. So you gotta make solid choices.
Well, and I think that regional gear difference is really interesting. I don't know if you've seen it in other things. Like I worked in an area of the Southwest where everybody loved Carhartts.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like, you needed those pants. Why are you not wearing those pants?
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm fine in shorts and my jeans. I don't know. What have I done wrong?
Nice.
Or other areas where everybody wears cowboy boots, because that just is kind of the culture of that region's archaeology,
mm-hmm.
Which I find really interesting. And of course, Southwest, when you go to conferences, you know, there's a certain jewelry markers
mm-hmm.
that you see. So I don't know if contract archaeologists have the same kinds of markers all the time.
I would say generally, probably yes. You know, we definitely have some regional attitudes toward different types of clothing and what you're going to wear. But that being said, there's always somebody in the project that's just worked all over the country and they have what they have, you know, they have whatever suits them, and they're not going to participate in that culture. But you can usually pick out, like you said, you can usually pick out the regional people that don't really leave their region much. And they're there. Like when we go to the SAAs next week, you know, the Society for American Archaeology Conference, you'll be able to kind of pick out the different regions of people just by looking at how they're dressed, because people like to express themselves with clothing and jewelry and stuff like that, of course. There's always the Indiana Jones guy there, too. Somebody is there straight up, you know, Indiana Jones hat with the shirt and the pants. I mean, all they're missing is a whip, honestly. So, I don't know. There's always, like, that one guy that just does that. So, anyway, we're going to go to another break, our final break, and then we'll come back on the other side of this and wrap it up.
This is Christopher Sims, host of the Go Dig a Hole podcast. It's a show geared for early career archaeologists where I bring interviews and casual panel discussions about the challenges and opportunities that many archaeologists encounter starting off. So, if you're still in school, thinking about going back, just getting started, or want to take the next step, you'll find what you need to go dig a hole. Tune in every other week on the Archaeology Podcast Network.
All right, we're back. And, you know, we've been talking this hour about the, I sound like Ira Flato, Science Friday. Anyway, we've been talking this hour, as though there's another hour, about the material culture of archaeologists and, you know, our things and what we have. But I just went through my own somewhat existential crisis regarding books, okay? And I know even if you're not an archaeologist, I mean, a lot of people have issues with books. If there's things we collect, that's typically it, right? And if you go through, and I think that, I don't know if that starts in, and it didn't start in childhood for me. I wasn't a big book collector. I honestly wasn't even a huge reader until I got to like high school. I didn't like it. I just didn't really get into it for some reason. I didn't have parents that really influenced that. So, you know, when I got into high school, I started reading some, you know, fantasy series as you do. But then I went into the Navy, didn't really, you know, pick up my reading. But then I went into college after that. And, you know, when you start paying hundreds of dollars for a single book, you tend to want to keep it sometimes. And that's what I did. I went into an aviation program. I went into some math programs and then finally archaeology and anthropology. And, you know, you pay so much for these books and you're thinking, wow, I must be able to use it sometime some other day, you know, so I may as well keep that on my shelf. And that's actually the case for a lot of my anthropology books, you know, their theory books and things like that. I have gone back and actually referenced those in certain cases for certain things. So it is good to keep those. The trigonometry and calc 3 books I've got on my shelf, however, I've never gone back to once and opened those, so I could probably get rid of them. But you know, it's a $150 textbook, so I tend to want to keep it. But that being said, books, you know, I was mentioning in a previous segment, you know, the books that we traveled across the country with, and it, you know, my wife and I have moved a number of times, and we just moved from a 3-bedroom apartment to a 1-bedroom condo. And while the square footage is not that much less, it's just bigger rooms. You know, we probably could have worked out to have bookshelves all over the place and keep all these books. But I started thinking, why do I have all these books? Now, my reference books, my archaeology books, and I've got a kind of an old book collection as well. I collect like old, you know, antique like science books. Like I've got this arithmetic reader here from like 1892 or something. I just love it. Anyway, But as far as all the other books goes, you know, I buy a lot of nonfiction. I buy a lot of just like general science books and, you know, Lawrence Krauss and Michio Kaku and things like that and Neil deGrasse Tyson, just because they're fun to read. But why do I need to keep those on my shelf? And I started thinking about it and I really had to come to the conclusion that I have these books on my shelf so other people will see that I have these books on my shelf. Once I actually said that out loud and I was like, I'm never going to read this book again, partly because there's other books to read. And I'm partly because this book is now 5-6 years old and some of the ideas, concepts, and theories have been replaced by other books. So it's not like going back and reading like a great work of philosophy or something like that. I'm a lot of these general science books and some stuff like that, I'm really not going to pick up again. And I'm not going to like will to somebody. I mean, if I was ever to have children, they're probably, you know, the likelihood of them cracking open a regular book on a regular basis is vanishingly small. I mean, they're going to have a tablet and they're going to download whatever they need. So, and that's what I do now. Most of my books I just download and read and then I have them. Then I don't have to worry about where I store them. So that tying into this long story, on the Archaeotech podcast, we interviewed Abby Smith Rumsey just a few episodes ago, depending on when you're hearing this. And I'm looking back here. She wrote a book called When We Are No More. And it was all about our, you know, preserving our digital heritage and our future and things like that. And I told her about this on the podcast and she had a great answer. She's like, I give away books all the time. She's like, you know, she's an archivist. She talks about all these things, but she gives away books all the time because she says once she's enjoyed the book, if it's not something she's actually going to reference on a regular basis, something she's going to use a lot, then she'd rather somebody else had a chance to enjoy that book. And she'd rather it moved on and enriched somebody else's life. So I kind of, I kind of took that to heart, and the last thing I moved from our old apartment today was about 5 boxes worth of books, and there's another 3 down in our storage locker, and I'm going to go through all that stuff and probably give most of it away. I'm targeting little things. I've got some organizations I want to give books to, and the rest will probably go to this bookstore in town that just buys, like, you know, 5 for a dollar, and then they go sell them for $2 a piece, so you can get a good book at a really cheap price. But I don't know. I met with some criticism when I put this online, saying that I was going to get rid of books, and one of my friends commented, and he said, I will put an addition on my house before I get rid of any of my books, you know, just to house the extra books that he has. And I'm like, why do we do this? I mean, I love the thought of having a massive library in my castle with my huge fireplace. I mean, don't get me wrong, you know, with the ladder that goes all the way around the thing, right? I mean, that would be fantastic. We all kind of fantasize about that. But on the other hand, I can also see myself sitting in my nice, clean Apple Store style den with my HoloLens on and surfing my books digitally with my hands, like Minority Report or something like that. I can also see that at the same exact time. So I don't know. What's your thought on books, April? I'm sure you're surrounded by books right now.
Okay. So we have a family history of what I will call book hoarding. As when I was like 10, my parents moved me into the attic. And as part of this, I got like a space dedicated to my books.
Nice.
And bookshelves. And as I age, I'd have to purge my shelves by simply boxing up the books and putting them into storage in the attic spaces we weren't using as my room. And so now my family's discovered that combined we have like 40 boxes.
My God.
Of books in storage, plus all the books that are actively on shelves filling our whole house.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized for me, part of it is books represent different like life stages.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's that phase when you're in like middle school and like ghost stories are really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then like my mom had a Russian fiction phase in college. So she has like all of these like famous Russian. Is she ever going to read them again? No. Is anyone in our family going to read them? Probably not. But we maintain all of these because they represent like life moments.
Mm-hmm.
So like your calc book is a life moment for you.
It is.
And so it kind of marks these things. So books are very symbolic markers. But yeah, at the same time, there comes a moment and you're like, oh my God, there's no more room. Like my bookshelves are like too deep now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know what's in the back anymore. I've lost track. I don't have a clue. And I've seen this, especially with archaeologists who are starting to retire.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do with that lifetime of books that you've collected? And also with journals.
Oh my God, journals.
So I recently got some emails being like, you know, hey, do you know anyone who's interested in the essays dating, like American antiquity dating to 79? I have every edition if people want them.
Mm-hmm.
It's all online. I really don't need, but at the same time, I'm building up my own stack. There's a shelf in my office that's, you know, the journals that come every couple of months because we get them. And there's something about a material object that I do better just like flipping through it. Mm-hmm. I'm more likely to like sit somewhere and flip through it than I am to go and log on online and see what all the articles are. And so I don't know. It's a really complicated issue, I think, for archaeologists because we are keepers of material culture. We mm-hmm. study material culture and we understand sort of meanings that are embedded in it for people.
Yeah.
And so I think we vest a lot in these books. But at the same time, I don't think I'd feel the anger of someone purging out their book collection. I periodically have to do it just to maintain peace in my home. But I have a collection of truly trashy archaeological fiction and fantasy. And, you know, they're horrible. Some of them I'll never read again.
Mm-hmm.
They're truly bad. Some of them are brilliant and very interesting. But I don't want to get rid of them because I've been kind of slowly collecting these.
Yeah.
So I think the other route I've started taking is instead of buying new books, I try to only buy, unless they're professional books that I truly need for my job and my research, mm-hmm. I try to buy everything used because then I also have less attachment to it.
Yeah.
And so for trips, I go to Goodwill and I buy like a bunch of $1 books that I can leave at the beach. I can leave in the hotel. So I kind of leave like a trail of books behind me where I go now.
It's well, you start prioritizing different things in your life too, as you well know. Mm-hmm. You know, you something you think is important one day, you know, and then you have a life change, and now other things are important, you know, and you have to, you know, maybe clear out some books to give way to other things. But I do like the thought of having of books representing like moments in your life. That's actually absolutely true. In fact, just going through the books I've gone through, I can almost remember, whether that's an accurate memory or not, I don't even care, but I can almost remember like when, where I was, you know, what time it was, you know, what, when I finished that book or when I was reading that book, you know, what was going on in my life. Cause I know for a lot of people who have, you know, career jobs and they got out of high school or college and they had been in the same job for 15, 20 years, they might not be able to do that because they read all their books from home or maybe on vacation or something. But in the last 10, 15 years, I've been in a different place, you know, every month, every year, something like that. And a book kind of represents, like you said, a time and a place that I was where I can remember, you know, reading that book. And sometimes I'll even write in the back of the book when I finished it, I'll write the date and the location where I'm at. Like if I'm in a hotel in a city or something like that, I'll write that down. But one of the things that really gets me about books, though, that really infuriates my OCD is I need them to be searchable. You know, like I have all these archaeology books sitting here behind me, and I have a vague idea of what it's about based on the title and like how I've categorized them. But honestly, there's probably some information in there that I'll just never be able to find because it's a reference to something that might be important, but it's not indicated by the title. The author just thought to include that, and it's completely unsearchable. So I really, that is kind of the big push for me to go digital, because the entire book is now searchable when it's digital. And I love that. I want to be able to search my entire collection and just say, find the word, you know, whatever, and show me all the books where this takes place. And that would just make me so happy. But I don't think we're not quite there yet, partly because a lot of these books, a lot of archaeology books in particular, are published by authors that might have gone through a university press or something like that. And, you know, it didn't get a lot of play. So maybe it's not on Amazon. I mean, hell, my book's on Amazon. So I guess if my book's on Amazon, probably every book is. But the funny thing about that, too, is mine went on Amazon right away. But it didn't get a Kindle version. And I'm not sure who was responsible for that. But it didn't get a Kindle version and therefore searchable, I think, for like a year and a half, 2 years, something like that. It's been out, I think, 3 years this spring, and in almost 2 years it took to get a Kindle version of that. Like I said, I don't know who's responsible for it, but it certainly wasn't me. Otherwise, it'd have been out way sooner. But I need it to be searchable. I don't know what to tell you. That's my big thing.
I think that's going to be a growing thing for a lot of people, too.
Yeah.
But there is still just something about tangible books.
That's true.
That I really think, you know, again, going back to this importance of material culture for archaeologists, I think, you know, I will have a digital copy and a hard copy of certain things, so I can search mm-hmm. the digital and then go read it in the hard copy.
Mm-hmm.
In part because, I like the comfort of the book. I process the information better, I think.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're a dying generation that will be replaced by extra techno-savvy young people. So,
well, I think we have as far as material culture goes, to get back to the theme of the show, I think we're in a serious generational shift on this thinking, because a lot of us, you know, like you and me and people we know, you know, we have this attachment to books, but then at the same time, we're also like almost being forced, but I think we're going willingly into this sort of minimalist idea as well, where we're getting rid of other things. We're being encouraged to, you know, not buy as much, at least not by like society, but by our peers, and just like owning less, and you know, we're getting more devices, like, you know, like a smartphone, you know, like you know, I don't know. There's a couple people out there that just got us into the smartphone age just a few months ago. I don't know. That's kind of crazy to me. But anyway. But like a smartphone, you see that once you get that, they're called smart for a reason, because that phone, if you use it right, can actually do like 100 different things, right? Whereas 10 years ago, when I had a different phone that wasn't a smartphone, that's all it did was be a phone. And that makes me sad, because I want it to do other things. Because, I mean, my phone, oddly enough, I got a phone call like right as we were starting this podcast. And I had to delay, but I mean, I hardly ever use this thing as a phone. I use it to track my calories, to track my exercise, to read on, to look at news, to socialize, to, I used it to level and hang a picture that then tried to kill me. I, you know, all these different things, and I did all that with my phone, and that to me is fantastic. And when I start thinking about that in relation to like my book collection, and I start thinking about Star Trek, The Next Generation, where, you know, people are just trying to downsize and minimalize because they want to focus more on experience and events rather than on the things that they take with them. And I'm kind of fine not having those remembering things around me, like books and my coffee mug collection and my, you know, my wine glasses. And you know, so what, I forget that we went to this place 2 years ago and had a great time. I think the point of that is to just replace memories with more memories and stop being stagnant and just keep on going and stop worrying about material culture and start focusing on just living life and experiencing new things all the time rather than constantly living in the past with the things that are chaining you to that past. Maybe that's a little extreme, but I don't know. Thoughts on that, or I go off the rails?
I'm just thinking that you're the bane of archaeologists of the future.
Right?
As you purge off all of your material culture.
Oh my God. But, so,
you know,
much.
This has been a discussion, especially, you know, in museums and archives and people who deal a lot with media,
mm-hmm.
like the material culture of our media, is what do we do as everything becomes digital, as people purge off things, and have less, you know, no one writes letters anymore.
Yeah.
You don't, you know, my mom kept an album of cards that she was sent by people when she was a teenager and kid.
Yeah.
And I throw them in the recycling bin. I don't want to keep everybody's Christmas card and thank you notes. And I read them. I say, oh, how lovely. I put them on the fridge for a week and then they go in the recycling bin. So what does this mean for archaeologists? I think is kind of a fun question for us to think about as we pursue our careers and as we have our own attachments to our kind of professional material culture is, you know, we study these symbols. We think about material objects as symbolic markers of different groups of people and allow us to understand past social organization. But what do we do and how does it help us or not help us even think about the cultures that we are currently studying in the past to think about our own material culture habits mm-hmm. and all of the things that, you know, are we kind of cast aside or we move away from using and keeping mm-hmm. or we multi-purpose with. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I think as we close out here, I think the concept of a digital archaeologist, which I feel like the Archaeo Gaming crowd is really pioneering.
Yeah.
The concept of a digital archaeologist is going to be more and more of a thing because you're right. The archaeologist of the future in 50 years, when my existence right now, if we don't change our rules, becomes historic, how is somebody going to research what I was doing right now? Well, they can look through my material culture, but I literally, in the last 2 weeks, once I decided to get rid of books, it's like I opened the floodgates and I just started throwing everything away. Stuff I've been hanging on to, stuff that I've had for 20 years. I mean, I had t-shirts from high school that were like, oh, this was my senior year, you know, shirt. And why the hell have I been? I haven't been able to fit into that for like 18 years. So why did I keep it? Now, one of them my wife kept and she's wearing it. So there's that. As long as I can repurpose it. But I got rid of bags and bags and bags of stuff that I was just like, open the floodgates. I'm done. But that being said, when somebody looks back on my stuff, you know, when I die, whenever that is, I'm hoping to die with very few things on me. And if they want to go back and see how my life was, they're going to have to look at my digital material culture. They'll have to look at my Facebook profile, my, you know, the Archaeology Podcast Network podcast that we have up. you know, other things like that that only exist digitally, which is why it's so important, as Abby was talking in that Archaeotech podcast, it's so important to figure out how are we going to archive and preserve our digital heritage. You know, how are we going to do that in a way that makes sense, that isn't so scattered? You know, that's still a question that we haven't really answered, because, you know, is anybody even going to know that I had a Snapchat account? I've only used it a few times, but I have one and there's stuff on there. That's part of my history. But is anybody going to know that in 10 years when Snapchat doesn't even exist anymore? Or what about Facebook? We have so much stuff on there and it's going to be replaced by something. That's called evolution of technology. It will, even if it modifies itself, it's going to be replaced by something that people will jump to, and then it'll shut down. So, you know, how do we preserve that stuff? That's the big question. But anyway, final thoughts. We're going a little over on this, but that's okay. Any final thoughts on this, on the material culture of our lives as archaeologists?
No, I just think it's going to be interesting to see how it continues to change, you know, as new generations enter the field and as archaeologists become more mobile. And I think also as things like academic jobs potentially decrease and change in how they're structured too.
Right. Yeah. We got to consider how to start teaching the future generations of archaeologists how to deal with this stuff. So, I think we'll end there, but, you know, leave a comment wherever you heard this podcast and let us know what your Achilles heel is. If you had to move tomorrow, what are you taking with you? You know, what can you just not get rid of? If it's books, that's great, but I want to hear other things too, you know, especially if you're like a traveling, you know, travel for your job or something like that. Like what always goes with you? You know, I'd love to hear that. So anyway, thanks a lot. Thanks, April. And, see you guys next time. Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. This show is edited by Christopher Sims of the Go Dig a Hole podcast. Go check it out. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.